Father in the heavens, I join with my brothers and sisters here today. Please, we beg you, please, to quicken every right word, every true word that I bring forth. Quicken me by your Spirit for the benefit of the brotherhood. And please cause every erroneous thought to fall to the ground unnoticed. Committing this into your hands, we pray in the name and through the blood of Yahshua of Nazareth. Hallelujah. Amen indeed. This presentation is actually going to be a call to holiness. And we're going to find that murder in society is a tip-off. It's kind of a barometer of where our society is at. Some of this material is very hard. This is not for everybody. It's for those who are called to holiness. It is for Yahweh's people. It's not for everybody. At times you'll think that I'm going to be a social justice warrior, and I'm really not. That's not where my heart's at. But I'll be talking about some things that are unpleasant in society, and talking about our response to them. My objective is to get you to think about what you could be doing. I don't know what to tell the people who keep track of the archives, because so far the presentations have been titled very predictably, the first commandment of 10, the second commandment of 10. In this case, I'm rather thinking it should be called murder, closer than you think. We'd like to think of murder as something way far away that doesn't affect us, but it is closer than you think. And I'm going to use this as a stepping stone to a call to holiness. This is a crude outline. I'll talk about the command itself, meanings of key words in the command, the sixth commandment, Yahshua's exposition in the great sermon, ways of breaking the command, strategies going forward, conclusions. Let's look at the command itself in Exodus 20, verse 13. It says, "Thou shalt not kill." There was a, we'll talk about that Hebrew word, 7523, in a moment. But this goes back to Genesis, the most ancient version of this command. Genesis 9, 5 to 6. Yahweh says to Noah, "And surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it. And at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man." Emphasis, "Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of Elohim made he man." Boy, isn't that what propels so many issues, that we are made in the image of the Almighty. There was a humor magazine, tried to make some humor out of the 9/11 tragedy. They had a mock interview with the Almighty. And he said, "I made it very clear to you in this mock interview." The Almighty says, "The commandment only has four words and every word has only one syllable." Now, some of us will look at that and say, well, there are situations where you have to kill. Really? For example, there are people in your charge, people you are protecting. And if someone is attacking them and they don't relent, you may have to kill them to beat them off. You know, but that's extremely rare to have to do that. So some people will modify that a bit. And they'll say, "Thou shalt not murder." And that is a nice way to fine-tune it. Because it starts with, "Thou shalt not," emphasis on the word "not," it is traditionally considered a negative command. It doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it's telling you it's a prohibition. Don't do this. Let's look at that Hebrew word. Hebrews Strong's number 7523. Ratzak. Ratzach, and it's a primitive root, properly to dash in pieces. That is to kill a human being, especially to murder. Now the stuff in red, when you read your Strong's Concordance, here's how you understand what it's saying. Those words you see at the end, those are all the ways it's translated in the King James Bible. So I put those in red. It's been translated put to death, kill, slay or manslayer, murder, murderer. So that's the basic meaning of the Hebrew word in the command. The prophet, the great prophet, I think it's Isaiah, he said that When the Messiah comes, he would magnify the law. Why do so many people have a problem with that meaning, that Yahshua would broaden the scope of the law, to deepen it and internalize it and radicalize it, to make it go into every crevice of your soul? I'll be reading an extended passage, Matthew 5, verse 14 to 26. You are the light, and I'll be interrupting myself with little comments. You are the light of the world. Already, he's calling us to a higher plane. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid, neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it gives light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and honor your Father which is in heaven. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass away, one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Whoever therefore shall break one of the least of these commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. He's saying, don't look to them. They're not your example. You're going to have to do better than them. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of the Gehenna of fire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him. Lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, you shall by no means come out of there till you have paid the uttermost farthing. By the way, the Day of Atonement's coming up. Be a great time between now and then to patch up any dangling stuff between any of us. According to the scriptures, we only have two choices when we're offended. Either A, forget about it, let it go. Or B, if it's eating away at you, you got to go back to the person and make it right. Make peace. It's funny, according to the scriptures, the offended one has the one who's got to speak up. The one who's hurt has got to speak up. Often you will find that these offenses are unknown to the perpetrator. He didn't know or she didn't know that their action or lack of action, their words or lack of words were offensive. And so often this explains why it's up to the offended party to speak up. The Torah requires you to speak up. I'm not picking on girls here. A little later on I'll be elevating the role of women in our lives. But girls, sometimes you girls give us the silent treatment. We do something wrong. We say something wrong. And then it becomes a guessing game. Malachi 3:16 says, they that feared Yahweh spoke often one to another. The Bible leaves no provision for the silent treatment, the cold shoulder, the snub. You've got to speak up. And you've got to work at it. Say, you said something that bothered me. Why did you say it that way? And for those we've offended, we have to be ultra sensitive. We have to be ultra receptive. We can't blow it off. This is a great time for us to patch up if there's anything dangling, or to lay it at Yahweh's feet and say, forgive him, just forget it, it ain't worth it. Let me underline some words here. Whoever is angry with his brother without a cause, I've underlined that and put it in bold. Anger without a cause. Sometimes anger is the right response. And one clue you can watch for is the things that got Yahshua angry. Very few things got him angry, but there were some. If we could limit the things that get us angry to the things that get Yahshua angry, I think we'll be doing very well. But sometimes there's a reason. We'll get back to this anger without a cause in a few minutes. Who shall say to his brother, Raca? Now that's the Aramaic form of a word, rake. And a Hebrew word, rake, and it just means nothing. Whoever says to his brother, you're nothing. Interestingly, Yahshua puts this in the context of murder. Isn't that interesting? You'll be in danger of the council. That's right. You should have the freedom to bring a brother before the board of elders if he's insulting you. There's a family I know back east who's got kind of a liberal bent. They rarely spank their children. The adult parents, they were raised in the hippie generation, you know, let the kids do almost anything. But I'll tell you, when that daddy pulled out the switch, he did it because they called each other names. He would not tolerate the children calling each other names. I saw it with my own eyes. Spanking a child bare bottom for calling a sibling, I don't know if it was a girl or boy, calling a sibling stupid. They would not tolerate that. Whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of Gehenna fire. Now that's eternal judgment. So Yahshua is saying it's not enough to avoid murder. You can't even hurt them with your words. Gehenna fire, that's eternal judgment. I highlighted that in blue. That's the end game. Okay, when you are then sent to Gehenna fire, I hope no one in the sound of my voice or in my space goes there. But there's no court of appeal there. The ball game's over. So this is serious business. Yahshua covered a lot of ground there with his teaching. I'm going to take a closer look using rabbinic doctrine. It's rare that I dip into rabbinic doctrine, but sometimes they express things very well. Furthermore, I'll be quoting from Wikipedia and also from a Jewish source on the internet. When I quote from Wikipedia, let me make something clear. You cannot prove a point with Wikipedia. You can only make a point. Wikipedia sometimes has problems, okay? But if the summary matches the other reading I've done, then I'll bring this forth. Wikipedia is a great start, you know, but when they summarize this issue of character assassination, Lashon Hara, Lashon meaning tongue, Hara, the evil, tongue the evil. It's a doctrine within the Jewish community to be real careful what you say about people. Speech is considered to be Lashon Hara if it says something negative about a person or party, is not previously known to the public, is not seriously intended to correct or improve a negative situation, and is true. Statements that fit the description considered to be Lashon Hara, regardless of the method of communication that is used, whether it is face-to-face, conversation, a letter, telephone, email, even body language. Oh, fiddles. I failed to print out the part from the Jewish source. I have printouts here, but I failed to print out the part from the Jewish source. So I'm going to try to summarize those from memories. There is an exception to the warnings of Lashon Hara, and it's primarily to protect others. For example, if you're about to go into a business transaction with somebody, and I say, wait a minute, you may not notice, but this guy's got a long criminal record of, you know, stealing. Are you aware of that? Or I tell you something negative to protect you or to protect a bunch of people. So there are practical exceptions to this. So this strikes me as being connected to this issue of murder, character assassination. Let's talk about this business of hate without a cause. When you ask Rabbinic Judaism, why was Jerusalem destroyed in 70 AD? They will typically tell you that it was destroyed because of hate without a cause. Now, interestingly, Yahshua said something in the book of John. He says, if I had not come and spoken unto them, they had not had sin, but now they have no cloak for their sin. He that hateth me hates my Father also. If I had not done among them the works which none other man did, they had not had sin. But now they have both seen and hated both me and my Father. But this has cometh to pass, that the word might be fulfilled that is written in their law, they hated me without a cause. This is a striking intersection between Rabbinic Judaism, their explanation for losing the beautiful city to Rome, to the Roman Empire, And Yahshua's explanation of what spiritual dynamics were at work. They hated him without a cause. We find this as a common theme, that the clergy, the establishment, is often the most vigorous and hateful in attacking the truth. That phrase, they hated me without a cause, you'll see it in Psalm 69, verse 4. And I just quoted from John 15, verse 22 to 25, for those who are getting an audio version of this. But in the lower right-hand corner of this page, I insist, this is basic stuff. This is really basic stuff. People might call this spiritual death, you know, killing somebody with hate, needless hate, slander, whatever. I'm going to transition to more contemporary versions of breaking the sixth commandment. One of that is the elimination of unwanted children. And these are political figures here. I'm not commending them for your vote. They just happen to be great cases of moral response to what others would say is a hardship. Rick Santorum and his wife Karen had a little girl named Isabella. They call her Bella for short. He wrote a book about the experience. Now, this is why he pulled out of the presidential race, what was it, about 4 years ago? I was involved with a group called Concerned Women of America. We were trying to get so that pornography was not on the internet workstations at the libraries. We're trying to make it so that the library workstations did not allow pornography. And I remember Rick Santorum helped us get legislation at the national level about this. The details elude me now because it's been a long time, but Rick Santorum distinguished himself in my eyes back then as being an advocate for a pure society. Essentially, we did not want to see the library become a peep show. I don't know how else to say it. We had this child about 4 years ago, and Isabella has some kind of a disease that makes her slow. Her thinking in such a slow... I have a virus. I'm getting over it. Please excuse me when I break like this. When he went forward with the birth of that child, him and his wife, they made up their minds. This is a human being made in the image of the Almighty. And he experienced what a lot of other people have experienced when they have a slow child. What happens is everybody else in the family becomes much more sensitive to the needs of people around them. They become better citizens, much better behaved, and much more attentive to their fellow man. It's interesting how believers in Yahshua, for some reason, appear to be the most equipped, best equipped to deal with a Down syndrome child or somebody like that. Now, Bella didn't have Down syndrome. It was another affliction. I just forgot to make note of it. One of the doctors were shocked that they went forward with this because the child's chances of survival are only 1 in 10. The doctor saw the little girl in bed as she started to mature, and he said, "Nobody told me this in medical school. They told me these kids aren't worth living. This child will play board games with the rest of the family. Very encouraging. She's a very loving girl." Rick Santorum, I heard him on the radio describe it. She's excellent at giving and receiving love. She's a member of the family, and she has a personality. But today's doctors are not trained to find value in this person's life. And as the family poured their love into the child, she thrived. Now, Sarah Palin, she insisted in her campaign season that child she had was perfectly beautiful. His name is Trigg. And this happens over and over again. These people who believe in Yahshua, they will have a child come forth that's slow, and the whole family's put on alert. We're going to watch over this child. We're going to bring this child up as normal as possible. And the family cultivates a sense of love, a sense of generosity that they could not otherwise have done. Lon Jacobs wrote an article for Wall Street Journal called Sarah Palin and Me, and he said the following. He said, "I have a beautiful daughter who lights up my world when I look into her trusting little face, who enriches our family with her life, and whose big-heartedness brings out the best in those who know her. I sometimes wonder how many Americans deprive themselves of that same joy because of an aggressive message that abortion is the only sensible choice. So here you have moral leadership in unexpected places. Just a little something I found out philosophically. In order for this universe to run at its best, you have to have something, you have to have some things that are a little off-center, a little negative, a little time-consuming. You have to have some hardship to bring out the best in you. And then that overrules the hardship, and it winds up being an avalanche of blessings. Someday I may talk about that more. But the universe really is driven by tiny imperfections, which lead to an overall beauty. What we find in Nazi Germany when they would systematically eliminate children who were slow, you found a culture of death. They just got meaner and meaner and more pagan. And they woke up one day from a national nightmare and said, "What have we done?" But again, a lot of this stuff is obvious. Spiritual death through false practices, popular seasons. I thank one of the brethren here for reminding me. How could anybody, shouldn't laugh at this. When I was a little boy, as a Catholic, I did trick-or-treating on one night, and the next day was All Saints Day. And it didn't occur to me that the Catholic Church had appropriated that. You know, now, this message is not for everybody. This is for a holy people. But I don't see how a holy people could be running around dressed up as goblins and spiders and all that crazy stuff. Man-made rituals. Is it right to call this spiritual death? Well, here's a passage many of us in the movement have cited for years, and maybe it's time to bring it back. Hosea 4:6, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because thou hast rejected knowledge, I will also reject thee, that thou shalt be no priest to me. Seeing thou hast forgotten the law of thy Elohim, I will also forget thy children." Knowledge of Yahweh and his ways is kind of rare. And people suffer for it. But we're going to go deeper. And the material is going to get kind of hard. I might get choked up. I know I got choked up at some parts of this putting it together. I'm only human. A wise man once said that the opposite of love is not hate. It's indifference. But you just don't care. Here's a commandment from the Torah that I absolutely love. Deuteronomy 22:8. "When thou buildest a new house, then thou shalt make a battlement for thy roof, that thou bring not blood upon thine house, if any man fall from thence." And you might see some mild debate about this. Well, does it apply to us? You know, we don't spend any time on the roofs of our homes like they did in the old days. Like, remember Peter on the roof praying? People spent time on the roofs back then. Carole King wrote a song in our modern era, "Up on the Roof," sung by the Drifters. A man invites his girlfriend to go to the roof of his apartment building and watch the stars from there. I suppose if we spend a lot of time in our roof, we ought to have some means of keeping people from falling off. I noticed the context here. I didn't notice that until today. "When thou buildest a new house," that suggests to me on the construction site, there ought to be some protection there. Let's go a little deeper. Again, the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. We're going to look at a bizarre fulfillment of this command. "When thou buildest a new house, then shalt make a battlement for thy roof. I emphasize that thou bring not blood upon thine house," murder, "if any man fall from thence." Back up, make sure I got everything in order here. Okay, we're going to look at the suicide nets of certain Chinese factories and living quarters. It's not here, this is in China. Got several of these. I want you to think about these. See, there are certain factories in China. Some of them are making the products in your own hands right now. People are killing themselves. What was going on there that they found it attractive to kill themselves? We hear about overbearing overtime hours, overbearing working conditions. So as a sweet, kind, and gentle expression of loving generosity, they put suicide nets around the buildings. Isn't that lovely? Here's more. Some of them are, I wonder how they appear on the screen behind us. What you see, they look like flagpoles sticking out of the building, some of them, and they suspend nets between them. Here's more. Some of them are obvious in these pictures. This happened as an outcry. An outcry. Now, you'll find some people justify the situation. They say, well, suicide rate is approximately the same at these locations as it is for the rest of China. But you see, there are business locations around the world. They don't have this. The only other thing that comes close to this, in the last couple of years, we've seen an extraordinary number of suicides in the banking community. Banking executives have pulled their hair out and said, I can't handle this. And they've taken their life. Here's one. How about that? You're coming out of the office and there's nets over you. How'd you like to come out of the office and see a guy just above you struggling to get out? Well, if that doesn't look like a Band-Aid, why don't they make things inside better for the people so they don't find it attractive to jump out? I'm going to spiritualize this commandment in terms of practical application. That's what we're supposed to do. That's Yahshua's example. How do these old commands and these old books apply to us? Deuteronomy 22:8 is a call for safety. Let's think, wait, what about safety? Let's think about safety. Not just, does that roof law apply to me? How do I do it right? Did I make the net big enough? Instead, think in terms of, how do I make it safe? We had a saying at AT&T, Bell Labs. Well, I was at Bell Labs, but I went to the AT&T Western Electric factory a lot. And there was a sign on the wall that said, there's no job so urgent, no work so important that we cannot afford to do it safely. And I commend this to those of you who are overseeing the construction over there. The Torah says that thou bring not blood upon thine house. Make sure that's safe over there, you guys. There's nothing more important, because if you have an unfortunate incident, it's going to be a blot on your heart for the rest of your life, and the rest of us are going to be walking around with a foot-long sourpuss on our face just thinking about it. There's nothing more important than safety. There's no reason for anybody to get hurt. And you can't say, well, I don't hate them. Because the opposite of hate in this case is not love. The opposite of hate is indifference. I'm sorry. The opposite of love in this case is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. Just not taking an interest in that. I'm not a social justice warrior, and that's not where this presentation is going. You may think that sometimes. But a call for safe working conditions is always reasonable. There's no reason for anybody to get hurt. You can call the people who work for me anytime and say, what was the most important thing on the job for Michael Banach? And they'll say, safety. We're going to talk about another area, call for safety. How about safety in the world at large? We're going to talk about pollution. A lot of people don't know this, but believers in Yahshua, there's an extraordinary number of them who are environmentalists at heart. Some of them are even activists. We can tell when Yahweh's great creation is being exploited. There's a verse in Revelation 11, actually two verses, 17 to 18. We give thanks, O Yahweh El Shaddai, which art and wast and art to come, because thou hast taken to thee thy great power and hast reigned. And the nations were angry, and thy wrath is come in the time of the dead, that they should be judged, and that thou shouldest give reward unto thy servants the prophets, and to the saints, that's you and me, and to them that fear thy name, that's you and me, small and great, and should destroy them which destroy the earth. Yahweh's watching. Let's talk about pollution a little bit. We're going to come full circle to some high matters of spiritual importance. This is from an article I recently lifted from ZeroHedge.com. I don't endorse everything there, but it is an amazing chronicle of financial conditions around the world. The title of this article is Chinese Air Pollution Kills 4,000 People Each Day, parentheses, and why it will kill many more, into parentheses. Now, the image you see there was nearby that factory that had the major explosion about a month ago. The acid in the air just corroded those cars you see parked there. That looks like a painting. That's actually a photograph. So in the article, I lifted these photographs from the article. Here a journalist takes a sample of red polluted water in the Jiangxi River in Luoyang. This looks like something from the book of Exodus. It's so red. There was no caption on this, but here's another polluted river. Here's a case where green doesn't mean good. Pollution from a factory in Yutian, 100 kilometers east of Beijing. How'd you like to breathe that when you wake up in the morning? Fill your lungs of air. Fishermen here in this photo clean up an oil spill at a site near Dalian Port, Liaoning Province in China. Let me just pause here. There'll be a little more. One thing we have going for us is that Western nations such as Britain and the United States do have a Judeo-Christian ethic. And despite all of the regression in society, we still have embedded to us a divine call for goodness. They get reminded maybe at Christmas or something, but it's still in the background there, always there, humming away. I had some students from India tell me that when an emergency vehicle goes through the busy streets of India, an ambulance, for example, in this country, we pull over to the side to let them go. In India, they don't do that. It's that Judeo-Christian ethic again tells us the people in that emergency vehicle, that's a human being. Their needs have value, and we pull aside. China has been, for the longest time, you know, through the communist era and beyond, primarily atheistic. They don't see, when they look at another person's face, they don't see somebody made in the image of the Almighty. So they're not as motivated to take care of this stuff. Here's a heavily polluted river in Zhejiang. Isn't it nice how the houses reflect in the water? You wouldn't want to go out and fish. You wouldn't want to take your fishing rods out there for dinner, would you? Here's the smog in Beijing. Those of you who are born recently might have a hard time relating to this, but in the 1960s, California, Los Angeles, California, started to look like this. The smog was legendary. Excuse me. And finally, enough people screamed. When I once drove through the Northwest Corridor of Indiana, it's considered a part of the Chicago metropolitan area because they get Chicago TV stations, Chicago radio, and other people. I drove through there once. It was a lot of steel there, a lot of steel factories and that. Wow, is it polluted. Now, this was in the 1980s. I was gagging. I couldn't believe it. The windows were all rolled up. Oh, was I choking. I couldn't believe people lived like that. That was normal for them. Since then, it's been cleaned up. Yeah, 4,000 people a day die from pollution in China. Is it any wonder? Well, okay, the next image is very moving. I'm going to show it only briefly. It's a very famous photo. For those of you who are only hearing a recorded voice audio, it's Uemura in her bath. There's nothing in here that will offend you or pollute you. Uemura is spelled U-E-M-U-R-A. Uemura in her bath. I saw this decades ago, and I wanted to bring it into the presentation. I found this photo in no time. It's a very famous photo. There's a factory in a certain province of Japan that was kicking out methyl mercury and poisoning the people around them. Nuts. I'm only human. I just get choked up thinking about it. So this famous moving picture, you can see it more later if you want. I'm just going to show it up for a moment. This is a Japanese mother bathing her deformed child. The photo was taken in 1971. Uemura appears to be in her late teens. She died in 1977. She was born with something called Minamata disease. Minamata is the name of a town. Now, these facts are so well established, I thought I'd grab Wiki again. If you don't want to believe him, you can go prove him or disprove him by other means. Remember, I saw this photo decades ago. It's unforgettable. It was first discovered in the Minamata city of Kumamoto Prefecture, Japan, in 1956. was caused by the release of methylmercury in the industrial wastewater from the Chiso Corporation's chemical factory, which continued from 32 to 1968. This highly toxic chemical bioaccumulated in shellfish and fish in the Minamata Bay. Not just shellfish, all fish. In the Shiranui Sea, which, when eaten by the local populace, resulted in mercury poisoning. While cat, dog, pig, and human deaths continued for 36 years, the government and company did little to prevent the pollution. The animal effects were severe enough in cats that they came to be named as having dancing cat fever. Let me take a moment here and talk about methylmercury. Now, when they first invented silver fillings, they didn't mean any harm. But they blended silver with mercury to create a way of transporting it into fillings that they cleaned out and give you a nice hard surface to chew with. They meant well. But those things, after a while, the seals start to wear down and the mercury starts to leak into your mouth. Here now, I'm speaking on this topic for myself. I'm not speaking for YRM. But I'm confident that there's nothing that's going to cause mischief here. I got methylmercury poisoning when I was taking vitamin B12 dots, those little pink dots. Well, I dissolved them in my mouth. And it was a point in my life where old fillings were starting to leak mercury. Well, vitamin B12, look it up. It's a form of cobalt. And when you blend cobalt with mercury, you get methylmercury. It's extremely toxic. I thought I had Lou Gehrig's disease. Parts of my muscles were twitching. I lost mobility in one of my fingers. Parts of my body were numb. Parts of my body were in pain. My joints, oh my gosh, my joints were hurting me. It was in the very end of 1998, I decided to have dental revision. Now listen closely. If you got strange symptoms, things that won't heal, problems in your overall health, you ought to consider dental revision. But don't go running to any old dentist and say, please get rid of this for me. Because if he's not dedicated, if the dentist is not dedicated to toxic-free dentistry, he or she is just going to grind that junk out and you're going to inhale the powder. You could get more sick. You got to go to a dentist who knows what he or she is doing. I had the greatest dentist in the world up in Chicago. It was a fantastic lady. And she was actually a leader in the industry. And on the other hand, I had the dental revision done before I met this fine dentist. They're hard to find back then. And the dentist was actually real close to Brother Hector's place. He was in Sterling, Illinois. Had to drive a long way to get there. It took 3 sessions. But 2 days after the final filling was replaced with something safe, I could get out of bed without having to crawl on the floor. But all that pain, all those funny symptoms went away. The American Dental Society is in a bit of a jam because if they openly admit this is a problem, they could detonate a lot of lawsuits. So they're just urging people to, in the future, go to non-mercury-based fillings. That methylmercury is brutal stuff. And there are people who've read the symptoms and they go, oh my gosh, that's me. But you got to go to a dentist who's dedicated to non-toxic dentistry. Because they'll put a dam in the back of your mouth so that when you're breathing, you're not inhaling that stuff. How did we get in this mess? Where our behavior, our culture, our industries all find it attractive to create risks for us. How did it become attractive to foster these conditions? Might we be playing a role? U.S. American environmentalists have made great strides, and I take my hat off to them. But American conquests are mostly completed. There's not much left in this country for them to go at anymore. So some critics say now they're going too far. For example, we had a lot of people in the Northwest woods who lost their jobs to protect a spotted owl. Environmentalists have far more work ahead of them in other countries. Unions in the USA went far in establishing safer working conditions. I celebrate that. But today they're powerless to overcome other areas crying out for improvement. Coal mines. Why is it that every 10 years we hear about another coal mine caving in? It's always the same thing. to find out that that hill or that mountainside had 24 safety violations and they hadn't shut it down, why are the unions powerless? Foreign work centers, as I described earlier. Migrant working conditions. We're going to talk about that in a bit. Migrant working conditions. I don't see the unions doing a whole... They do some, but they're not doing enough, in my view. Something's binding them. I'll make this a spiritual presentation, an answer to this in a bit. But let's talk about migrant working conditions. In 1960, on the Friday after Thanksgiving, there was a broadcast called Harvest of Shame. You can find it on YouTube. It was done by Edward Murrow, leading news correspondent of CBS back then, one of those top drawer news reporters. And he chronicled the life of the migrant workers back then. Now, back then, it was primarily Africans and whites. Well, what happened is these people just travel around looking for work, working for a pittance. And they live in these shacks, whatever was set up by the people hiring them that day. Some of these conditions are just horrible. This particular interview with this family broke my heart. I hadn't seen it since I was a teenager, and I saw it again. They asked this man, what is your family eating? And the only thing they had to eat, they just kept eating this one thing, was bologna sausage and bread. Now they're harvesting the food that we see on our pretty Thanksgiving tables. Pretty food, colorful, nicely arranged, abundant. These people are struggling and starving to create that for us. How did this happen? What? This is America. How did this happen? Now, on the left, you have an image from the CBS News documentary. It's only an hour long. It was mostly blacks. On the right is a modern bus carrying people to work sites, and you can see they're Hispanic, and they're just trying to show. It's the same thing, just different cast of characters. We'll talk about that movie in a moment. This, I want to point out, this was made in 1960. But knowledge of this goes way back. There's 1956, there was a movie called Giant. Anybody here ever seen the film Giant? Yeah. It's one of those great epics that just sort of goes by and nobody knows about unless somebody brings it to your attention. It's about an Eastern girl who marries a rich Texas land baron and she tries to acclimate. Different culture and everything. And she discovers the horrible working conditions for the Mexican farm workers on the ranch. Now this guy lives in a mansion. You'll see there on the right a promotional image from the film. Rock Hudson marries this girl from the East, Elizabeth Taylor. I kind of liked her in that role because she played a lady. Instead of this racy stuff she got into later in her career, she played a lady, a nice lady. And there was James Dean in his final role. He takes her, James Dean takes the ranch hand, takes this wife on a tour of the grounds, and he stops by the place where the Mexican farmhands live. It's a terrific image there from the visual. There's only going to be five of these now. But in the background, you see a cemetery. That's a great storytelling device to have something clearly in the background like that, because it implies that there's something deadly going on here. Here's a view of where the workers live. It's just beat up shacks and a cemetery. Who would want to live there? These are creating wealth for the Texas land baron. Over to the right, it's kind of hard to see. This wife, here's a baby crying loudly in that shack. And over to the right, she tries to go in. She asks permission to go in while the farmhand waits in the vehicle. She goes in and she picks up a very sick baby. The mom is sick. The doctor's too far away to come that far. She closes by promising to help. She's going to be back later. And she urges her husband to take an interest in his workers. And this becomes one of the many plot threads in there to urge upon her husband a care and concern for these poor Mexican workers. So I'm going to go off on a tangent here, girls. Men are naturally wired to please ladies. We don't have to be married to you. There doesn't have to be the hope of a romance. Men are naturally wired to please ladies. This is a power given to you. This, by the way, explains why our father Adam fell. he took that a little too far. Mm-hmm. There are times when we have to say no. I hope you understand there's a reason for it. If you girls could take this natural phenomena and use it to urge us to do good, to be better, to challenge us spiritually, you will seize the power of heaven. On the other hand, if you ladies use this natural phenomena to manipulate us, to get your way, to be a brat, if this is how you use it, it will recoil on you hideously, and you'll be missing out on a lot of love. You should use your feminine nature to inspire us. And again, I'm not talking boy meets girl. But in this film, that became a theme there. So this film was made 4 years before the Harvest of Shame video. Let me do an overview. Examples of dangerous work. Railroad constructions. The Chicago I&M Canal. Legendary. A canal running from Chicago, then south into the Illinois River. It was legendary how the Irish suffered and died there, often digging with their own hands. Coal mining, very dangerous work. Migrant farm workers, subject to disease, starvation, hardship. Heavily industrialized areas of pollution. High-tech industrialized farmer. Besides insisting on safety in our space, how can we be part of the solution? I wonder if somebody can run an errand for me. Brother Russell, do you see my computer bag over there? Anywhere? Maybe it's on a chair. Could you go over there, please? I'm sorry. We'll talk about a book here. There should be a book in there called Enough. Thank you. Could you bring it forward for me? I failed to take it with me. It was written by Bill McKibben. It doesn't matter that Bill McKibben, he might have some political views different than me. Thank you. There's a lot of books called Enough, so you really have to dig to find this. Enough, Staying Human in an Engineered Age. He talks about how a village in Asia, in Bangladesh, that's where the Bengal tigers are from, he talks about how they dealt with the Green Revolution, the nanotechnology revolution. They were given this yellow rice that had a lot more beta carotene for vitamin A. Now, that was a primitive version of that rice, but you had to eat like 15 bowls a day to get enough vitamin A. In the 1960s, in the heady early days of the so-called Green Revolution, Gorasane's farmers converted to a new high-yield rice strains from Western labs. And indeed, their yields grew. The rice jumped out of the paddy, said one older man, who was bare-chested and wearing a sarong. But the new strains demanded lots of fertilizer, more and more each year. And even so, the yields slowly fell. And since the villagers were now planting fields full of identical improved seeds, instead of dozens of different varieties, they needed lots of pesticides too. Over time, that began to cause trouble because Bangladesh is as much water as it is land, a soupy river delta where gentle floods are a regular part of life. It's the floods that make the land so fertile that allow 130 million people squeezed into the space the size of Wisconsin to feed themselves. Quote, when we women went to collect water, we would be affected, one villager told me as she stood in a field near her family's hut. She was in her 20s, beautiful, gregarious. Quote, our skin would absorb the poisons. It would get itchiness, get gastric trouble. A man spoke up. The cows used to eat the grass and drop dead. Then the villagers would fight each other. Another said, we grew up with a saying, Bengalis are made of rice and fish. Then the fish started catching diseases. We are not scientists, but we made the connection between pesticide and fish death. The author goes on, these people, remember, were not shoppers at Whole Foods who had read some brochures about pesticides. No one had come and told them they were feeling itchy. They itched. They didn't read it in a brochure. So a decade ago, when some farmers began experimenting with a low-tech scheme called Nayakrishi, or New Agriculture, several residents went to hear a presentation. Before long, they had convinced their neighbors to set up what could call we could call an organic farming zone, an area the size of a small county where all the peasant farmers, most of them with holdings of no more than an acre or two, pledged not to use pesticides or fertilizer. Instead, they experimented with dozens of different varieties of crops, not only different strains of rice, but sesame seeds and loofah sponge gourds, eggplant, sugarcane, bamboo, onions, pulses, and 30 different leafy greens. Those leafy greens are key. Jumping down, sometimes researchers think peasant farmers, being poor, are therefore stupid and in need of easy, prepackaged solutions from the magicians of the West. Transgenic crops are less complicated, explained Wellesley professor Robert Palberg. If you have smart seeds, you don't need to have farmers with the same instant upgrade of knowledge. It's actually easier for low-resource, illiterate farmers. When we cook the green vegetables, we are aware not to throw out the water, one woman in Gorsane told me. Yes, said another, and we don't like to eat rice only. It tastes better with green vegetables. I'm almost done with this reading here. This may sound unscientific, but peasant farmers in places like Bangladesh are starting to gather and trade crop varieties with as much careful attention as any biotech lab worker. At the local Nayakrishi training school in Tangail, farmers had planted 25 strains of papaya, 112 varieties of lovely jackfruit, each cataloged by taste, size, color, season, and habitat. Clay pots in a darkened shed contained 300 varieties of local rice, 20 kinds of bitter gourd, 84 types of local beans. Do you know how much it costs to build a gene bank like the ones where botanists store plant variety? Asked Farad Mazar, founder of the Nayakrishi campaign. No scientist can afford to catalog hundreds of varieties of rice, but farmers are doing it here as a household activity. Our little seed station has more vegetables than the National Gene Bank, which spends millions, but we can do it for free. See, for them, the Green Revolution was planting varieties of crops and doing everything very naturally. I want to use that as a stepping stone to other points I want to make. The things we're going to be talking about are not Pollyanna spiritual happy talk. I mean these points seriously. We really should reduce our dependence on goods and services which make exploitation attractive. I have to think long term. I'm a part of this thing as much as you are. If you look on eBay and Craigslist, you'll find me trying to sell things, get rid of things. Yes, goods and services which make exploitation attractive, that is, exploitation to the point of death, physical death, cultural death, family death, whatever you want. If you want to reprogram your mind, you say, well, Brother Mike, I'm just not geared up for this. Go watch Harvest of Shame on YouTube. And do likewise to learn about other points that I've made here. How do we reduce our dependence on those who are exploiting us or the land to the point of death? Here's the final solution. In Proverbs 14:34, it says, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. So I'm going to talk about an example of revival. There's a book here I'm going to talk about called England Before and After Wesley. It's so rare, you can see on this Amazon snapshot that there's a hardcover. I can buy it for $75, a used one. Another used one is $199. The book is called England Before and After Wesley. I know I've mentioned it before, but has anybody managed to read it? There's a nice summary on the internet written by a guy named Donald Drew. I'll be reading some selected excerpts from it. The last sentence on this thing on the panel: the fact of a phenomenal religious and moral degeneracy of this time was beyond dispute. This is in the early 1700s of England. What I'll be calling for is a response to a culture and society that bears some resemblance to what we have today. So I'm going to read some I'm going to read the whole thing. I'm going to read some highlights here. I got to read fast. Some of this will take your breath away. And then in comes John Wesley with his brother and another guy named Whitfield, and they turn the country around. I'm convinced that the reason Britain lost that war with America is because they were morally rotted. They couldn't even muster a decent army. They were so messed up. The clergy of the church, this is a summary of how bad things were. See if you can speak to this in your mind, if this matches anything you've seen, you know, in your space, in the world around you. The Church of England was corrupted, and that corruption spread from top to bottom of the populace. Succession of archbishops and bishops lived luxuriously, neglected their duties, unashamedly solicited bishoprics and deanery for themselves and their family. Parish clergy followed suit. Queen Anne Pertley and the first two Georges wholly filled their court with courtiers who flouted levity and practiced vice. Numbers of Christian students at Oxford and Cambridge were sent down because of their zeal in universities unworthy of the name, where dons busied themselves in their books and undergraduates immersed themselves in sport, wine, women, and song. A corrupt, even dead church darkened most aspects of English life. By the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713, England had wrung from France and Spain the monopoly of the slave trade, the financial greed which it bred and fed, the brutalizing of masters and slaves' lives, the indignity of labor that it engendered, laid a curse on the economic and political life of the century. By the way, the book of Revelation talks about those who trade in the souls of men. Moreover, the Industrial Revolution was gradually spreading, and these attitudes and actions influenced many owners of mines, factories, and mills in the treatment of their workers. The barbarities practiced in industry were bad enough, but those carried out on slave ships and then in plantation chill one's blood. It is estimated that the number of Negroes during the century transported largely in British ships from West Africa to America run into millions. Other evils flourished in politics, nepotism, place-seeking, bribery were the order of the day, especially at election times. For the first half of the century, the prime minister epitomized the management of men, means, money, and manipulation of laws through administration or the penal system. Britain at this time, more than any other, was two nations, the rich and the poor. The laws were devised largely to keep the poor in their place and under control. Thus, to steal a sheep, let's remember the Torah teaches us to have a punishment equal to the crime. To steal a sheep, to snare a rabbit, to break a young tree, to pick a pocket for more than one shilling, to grab goods from someone's hand and run away with them, were hanging offenses. Execution at Tyburn at London were known as hanging shows. They occurred regularly and drew huge crowds. As for the existence of jails, the transportation to Australia of both genders and of children, the flogging of women, the pillory and branding of the hand, the horrors continued unabated. The strangulation of Puritanism and the suffocation of deism had further inhuman consequences in the treatment and mortality of children. This one really hit home now. Their death rate tells its own tale, but only for London are authentic statistics available. These show that, for example, between 1730 and 1750, 3 out of 4 of all children born to all classes died before their 5th birthday. That's jaw-dropping. Now, today we have something going on, it kind of rhymes with that. We have a significant percentage of children who die before their 0 birthday. Do you know what I mean? James Hanaway, the Christian friend of parish and pauper children, produced scores of statistics pamphlets preserved in the British Museum Library, revealing his investigations into the treatment and death rate of the parish infant poor. Death occurring time after time because of murder and the practice of exposing newborn babies to perish in the streets. See, I'm using murder here and death as a barometer of a society's health, their spiritual health. A civilization is rightly judged by the way it treats people, and when people are treated inhumanely, they resort to desperate measures to survive. So it is not for nothing that in the 18th century in England is known as the gin age. The bestiality practiced upon children was often the result of drinking deep, fiery, poisonous gin, which outrivaled beer as the national beverage. Hogan's pictures, far from being caricatures, are realistic glimpses of the country's plight. Lucky defined the nation's gin drinkers' drunkenness as the master curse of English life. And of course, the inevitable evils followed: poverty, violence, prostitution, murder. Another desperate measure for survival encouraged by alcohol was the perverted concept of sport, which, like alcohol, brought attendant evils in its train, such as further coarsening of the personality, cruelty and gambling, the baiting of bulls, bears, badgers, and dogs with fireworks attached to them, were typical. Most of such tortures taking place in public house grounds, in a village green, or cathedrals. Often to provide greater excitement, these animals were baited to death. Many 18th century clergymen bred fighting cocks and had church bells rung to honor the local winner. The setting of trained dogs on ducks and lakes was another favorite creation. Boxing without gloves for men and women. A further interest in London and other big cities was immorality as a sport. Some of this I have to skip. I can't go on. And a judge once asked, how comes it to pass that no sooner is a playhouse opened, a theater, in any part of the kingdom, than at once it becomes surrounded by a halo of brothels? Nationally, we outlaw prostitution, except in the entertainment capital of America, Las Vegas. And it precisely matches what he's describing here. Open up a playhouse surrounded by brothels. As for lawlessness, thieves, robbers, highwaymen, footpads abound throughout the length and breadth of the land. As Horace Walpole observed, one is forced to travel even at noon as if one were going to battle. As far as savagery is concerned, consider the plundering of shipwrecked vessels lured by false signals onto rocks to the indifference shown to the drowning sailors. This was a regular activity along the whole coastline of the British Islands. Yeah, I'm skipping a lot. A year later, April 2nd, 1739, is a date of great significance for England and the English-speaking world because Wesley, in response to George Whitefield's invitation, arrived in Bristol and was convinced of the need for field preaching by Whitefield as the most likely means of reaching the greatest number of people, especially the working class, then as now virtually untouched by the established church. So the following day, despite his misgivings, but encouraged by Whitefield's example, Wesley, age 36, preached his first open air sermon. Unknown to either of them, the Great Awakening, the Evangelical Revival, was born. It was to be reared for many years in an atmosphere of insolence, contempt, abuse, and violence. Now, this next slide is from this, but I put it on the screen to give you a taste. If we would respond to Yahweh's call to holiness, if we as a people would respond to his call to be part of his epistle to the world around us, like the Bible says, you can expect pushback. You can expect some serious pushback. We ought to be teaching our young people how to stand tall, how to stand alone, how to get by with less. Here's what they called Wesley. Here's what they said about him as critics. That Methodist, that enthusiast, was described also by Anglican clergy as that mystery of iniquity, a diabolical seducer, an imposter, and a fanatic. What are they saying about you? For three decades, magistrates, squires, and clergy turned a blind eye to the constant drunken and brutal attacks by mobs and gangs on Wesley and his supporters. They endured physical assault with missiles of various kinds. Frequently, bulls would be driven into the midst of the congregations, or musical instruments blared to drown the preacher's voice. Time after time, Wesley's and Whitefield narrowly escaped death, while several of their itinerant preachers were attacked or their houses set on fire. Hundreds of anti-revival publications appeared, as well as regular, inaccurate, and scurrilous newspaper reports and articles. And the virulent attacks, not surprisingly, came from the clergy. Just like Yahshua said, they hated me without a cause. I'm going to go back to the notes. Almost done. John Wesley's life was a triumph of Yahweh's grace. Under physical attack and vituperation, thousands of times, never once did he lose his temper. Are we preparing ourselves for that kind of business? Come on, guys. If the end times ain't coming, then hard times, we know hard times are coming. We see a land that is ripening for revival. I think Yahweh's looking around the land and asking himself, who can I call? Who can I call? He loved his enemies, and to do what they would, they could not make him discourteous or angry. It is no exaggeration to say that John Wesley and all these things were true of Charles and Whitfield also, instilled into the British people a new and Christian conception of courage. His tranquil dignity, absence of malice and anger, and above all the evidence of Yahweh's Holy Spirit working in his life, eventually disarmed his enemy and won them for the Messiah. The effect of this erudite Oxford Don's preaching, whose speech was always classical English and whose bearing was that of a Christian gentleman, was invariably extraordinary. Gradually, soldiers, sailors, miners, fishermen, smugglers, industrial workers, thieves, vagabonds, men, women, and children listened intently. He won them over. For over 50 years, to such drink-sodden, brutalized, and neglected multitudes, Wesley held out the word of life. He was outspoken against slavery. He supported fair prices, a living wage, honest and healthy employment for all. There is no question but that Wesley was more familiar with the life of the poor than any other public figure of his age. Constantly moving all over Britain, he could and did sense the mind of the people as no king or statesman was able to do. Almost done. He and his associates literally turned that nation around. Yahshua tells us to pray to raise up laborers in the harvest field. You know, sometimes people wonder, oh, show me your will. What's your will? I want to know your will. And here the Bible tells us the things to pray for. We need soldiers like this. Now, this is where I slam on the brakes. It's so common, so very common, for well-meaning people to read about things like this in history and say, I want to be like that. And so then they try to enter into the exact experience of somebody from the past. It really is. It's a common problem. I am not here to tell you, go do what Wesley did. Go do it Wesley's way. Go to the people. Do it this way. Do it that way. No. What you should find out is, how does Yahweh want to work in this age? That's what I want you to think about. Take inspiration from guys like him, the apostles. Someday I may talk about the history of the apostles. History outside the Bible records a dramatic history of the apostles. Even if you cut away half of it, it's very thought-provoking. Wesley's theory was simple. You get a nation righteous and all the laws fall into place. All the stuff about pollution, treatment of workers, all that stuff would fall into place if it was a righteous nation. That's why any proposals you come up with in the political realm will always lack a lasting feel to them. O nation Stephen, the sins I just described will take no lasting interest in creating a safe society. A righteous nation would not tolerate evil. Get a nation righteous and the rest will fall into place quickly. In order for us to play a role in revival, at least two things must happen in our midst. One, we'll have to eliminate our dependence on goods and service, which promote a culture of death. I remember the great reformer Spurgeon. He felt guilty because he took a trolley car on Sunday. Now, to him, that was the Sabbath. But he looked back and he thought, I don't know if I should have done that. Because he's paying somebody who's gainfully employed on a Sunday to run a trolley car. But you have to eliminate all those little compromises to be a light to the world around. And number two, not just the elimination of things that promote a culture of death, but to prepare to sacrifice in ways unimaginable to convey the glad tidings. There's no question in my mind Yahweh is preparing a people. I want to know is if we individually will respond to that. This is a call to holiness. Expect pushback like Wesley and the apostles got. See item number one above. I sense that Yahweh is looking for excuses to send revival. This is my last panel here. In Jeremiah 30, verse 12 and 13, Yahweh gives us a clue to what he's doing. He says, thy bruise is incurable and thy wound is grievous. There is none to plead thy cause. That thou mayest be bound up, thou hast no healing medicines. I underline that part. There's none to plead thy cause. He's looking down to see if anybody will pray about these things. Who would pray for revival? Yahshua said to pray that laborers be sent in the harvest field. we have a leadership crisis at every level of our society. I think this is it for me. Yeah. Who will pray for revival? I want to stir up your souls as the Feast of Tabernacles is here, the Fast of Atonement, the time of self-examination. Despite all the evils in this country, would you love them enough to make the sacrifices to be part of Yahweh's solution? I can't get any more specific than that now. But if we use the culture of death as a barometer of a society's health, it doesn't look good. So that tells me, oh, it's time for revival. I'd like to be part of that. May Yahweh bless you.